Christians and Indians, and the topic this evening will be a concern with our common past. A note about what we'll be doing, you can come to all the sessions, you're invited. I'm very pleased with the response, or we can do this individually. And I'm going to structure them together. Tonight we'll take a look at the past, to talk about 20 to 30 minutes just to look at a past that, you know, takes a lot of effort, but to put a framework to share on that. Tomorrow night, I want to focus upon some of the main concerns that American Indians themselves have voiced as what are the most urgent things that need to be dealt with in relation to Indians and non-Indians. And then on Wednesday, we'll move our time until the morning on these concerns to 10:45. Wednesday, I want to talk about some of the barriers that exist between us and really to look at the present. Again, in that sense, racism and many other things, what we'll call that lead to misunderstanding and how they might overcome them. And then the final session that I'll be doing in this on Thursday morning will focus upon future possibilities to look hopefully and areas of cooperation between Christians and Indians. The focus for all of these concerns, as far as I'm concerned, is the issue of justice. How can there be fair treatment for all people in our land? And we're going to concentrate primarily upon the United States of America, although we might, you know, be aware of other things as well. And also the context or the setting is between Christians and Indian people, realizing very clearly that many Indian people are Christian. That's not the division between the two, but to put it in our setting as a response of Christian individuals and particularly of the churches. A couple notes on books, a note about myself, and then I want to share some things, but that's going to open up, and I'll watch the clock carefully, because the main thing is for us to share our own perceptions and our own experiences. I've asked the bookstore to, on this topic, just to add two items. There's a whole host of things, and if you're interested in bibliography, I can load you up on these things. One of them, and I get no royalties on this, by the way, a very brief summary, is called Justice for American Indians. It is a bit dated, 1977, a piece I did for the American Lutheran Church, a focus on federal Indian policy from a Christian perspective. Indeed, what I'll share would be an elaboration of a part of that, the historical part of that. And the other thing that I'll refer to a number of times, something I put here because I commend it very highly, and it is rooted in the Pacific Northwest, put together by some friends of mine out of Seattle, and some of you may know Marilyn Bodie and the others that have put this together. The one that's in the bookstore is the Participants Book, a series of six studies designed for study within Christian congregations, and the title is Christians and Native American Concerns in the Late 20th Century. It puts it in a biblical perspective, it deals a bit with the history, although it focuses on treaty issues primarily, and talks about the Christian response. Along with this that comes there is a piece done by the League of Women Voters, fairly objective in my viewpoint, of the situation in the state of Washington. And I would judge that has been the most tense situation of the last few years in North America and Indian, non-Indian relations, and also a book on the meaning of treaties. And so you might want to check that out if you have interest in doing this in your home congregation. Although some of the, well, let me add, there's another book that's not here that gives resources, and along with that, I think any concerned Christians could lead a group, take the materials that are there. I've used it in South Dakota and substituted some stuff from the Midwest and the Plains area for the Pacific Northwest material, and so that is usable. So I commend these, at least to look them over as sort of resources if you wish to pursue this. I'm Glenn Addison. For the last almost 15 years, I've been deeply concerned with Native American concerns as they relate to the Christian faith. I did not become even aware of these issues until I moved to South Dakota. That was 16 years ago. And there, in my contact with Indian students, with some tribal people in our state, I became aware of a number of things. I came into it as an interest in justice. I became keenly interested in the area of Native American spirituality, Native American religion, and I've been teaching this topic at Augustana College for the last 14 years, I think it is. And last week I did some sessions on Native American spirituality and what we might appropriate from that. And since that time, one thing led to another. I have had a chance to work with the American Lutheran Church, with the National Indian Lutheran Board, and with the Native American Theological Association. And the last group is where my main energies are now, is the development of Indian Christian leadership. It's a very urgent concern, but a very exciting thing that is taking place within the whole realm of Native American Christians in North America. The history. Let me take about 15 to 20 minutes to put a larger frame. If it's familiar for you, bear with me. And then to set into our own concerns and our own experiences in that framework, to look back, to perceive where we are at. A couple preliminary notes, and then I'll put that in terms of periods, a vast oversimplification. The first thing I would say, that history is grim indeed. It is essentially a history of injustice. It has not been treated adequately at all by our history books or by the media. And the first thing you're aware of is this discrepancy between the official report, so to speak, and what has happened. Secondly, it is my deep concern, I want to reiterate, that it is not my intention to put on a guilt trip in this area. And I know that because every time I speak to a Lutheran audience, and some of you are Lutheran, Lutherans go the guilt route, and that's not what I want to do, because I wasn't there, and my grandparents weren't there, and we didn't have any part of what happened in the past. Maybe we have something what happens in the present and the future. That's where we'll come to that. And besides, theologically speaking, guilt is a lousy motivator to get things done, because if you load that on people or on ourselves, we turn in upon ourselves and sort of forget the issue. I know Russell Means, that's the swear word out in South Dakota. If Russell Means is that he can go out to the churches and just sort of, in a few words, lay it on them, and he said the money rolls in for him on that. But it doesn't really produce, burns away from that. Our concern is to understand why we have come to the place where we are at. A good thing. One of the books I recommend with all its deficiencies is D. Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And he said, if alone here you're aware why things are like that on the reservation today, the book has served its purpose. That is enough. And a part of, I call it the Addison thesis, that I've convinced in the past that the friends of Indian people have probably done more harm to them than their enemies. And I should take this off the tape because I've been also getting into trouble in saying this, and it's not totally true. But the churches have probably had a worse record than the cavalry here in doing these things. And even though the churches and the missionaries in particular have meant well, and that's one of the areas that I've looked upon in the past, to understand. And finally, as background, if you stick around for several days, I believe there is a very crucial and central role for the Christian community in this thing. The churches from the very beginning have been advocates for Indian people. And simply that we be wise advocates if we are non-Indian Christians at this point. That history. There are tens of thousands of years of history before, but it is the encounter that has taken place in this continent. And I'll focus upon primarily the United States of America. Right now, their last census, 1.4 million Americans who claim in the census to be Native American ancestry. So that may be very small, but that's self-identification. That's about one half of 1% of our population. And unless you live in that northern tier of states or in the southwest, you can live your life without having contact or being aware of that. And so there's sort of a hidden part of America. The number probably never has been large. But the encounters came 1607, we might begin, Jamestown and that settling. And for that very part of a great part of our colonial history, I'll give a number of key words to sort of set these times into a framework. In different parts of the country, probably dealt with these at different times, and my scheme reflects very much a Midwestern attitude. A time of alliances. That Indian nations, and there were many nations, quite distinct, as the nations of Europe was, probably even more distinct in that sense because of the language difficulties. But the general picture is that these communities welcomed the settlers at first to come into their land. Some exceptions to this, and the pattern came about that, you know, there was misunderstanding. That's one great word for that whole of the history that is there, of the meaning of land, the meaning of possession, misunderstanding and communication. But throughout much of our history, almost to the very beginning of our nation itself 200 years ago, the balance of power lay with these Indian nations. It was important for the Spanish or the French or the English or whatever group came over to have them as friends. In fact, the foreign policy of those countries was really gaining friendship and getting into alliance with them, and that happened on the local level as well. But our nation came into existence at the end of the colonial era, at the beginning of the nation. I think we might characterize that relationship by the phrase that's in the Northwest Ordinance as it opened up that area north of the Ohio River. Good faith. Indian lands were not to be taken except in just means. They're to be treated fairly. At the time of George Washington, we can look at these earliest accounts of treaties that were there. We're to treat with these people as we treat with others, as human beings. We inherited a part of this policy from the British and the nations that were here before us, in justice and fairness. There's still that balance of power that needed to be maintained. We needed their goodwill, their welcome that was there. But whatever the precise dates, that shifted very early in that 19th century, perhaps in the 20s, if not before. When more and more Europeans came over this land, and after the War of 1812, we poured over the mountains, it was realized by both friends and enemies of the Indian people, and there were both, it would be bad news to live alongside one another. And so it began late in the 1820s. And with a vengeance, and I choose that term literally, in the 1930s, the whole movement of Indian removal that is now going to be a pattern that is repeated many, many times. The great figure associated with that is President Andrew Jackson, who defied the Supreme Court of the United States to accomplish this. And so you have the phenomenon now, if you come from the East, except in pockets in the mountain areas or in the extreme north or in the Seminole area in the extreme south, relatively little Indian population. Maybe you come from Indiana, you know, state named after this phenomenon, and there aren't many Indians. Muncie, Indiana, the Muncie Indian tribe, they moved out to Wisconsin, and they're still there. They're Lutherans, by the way, most of them, and that, the Stockbridge Muncie Indian. But removed to Indian territory. And Indian territory at that time was that vast, almost unknown realm west of the Mississippi, already occupied by other Indian nations. But it was for their good, as most decisions regarding Indians was to be. A part of that, if you know your history or the symbols, were that famous Trail of Tears in the mid-1830s, where some of the Cherokees and other so-called civilized tribes, the name was applied to them from the outside, were forcibly moved from the southeast, primarily from Georgia, and planted, you know, west of the Mississippi. By the way, that Indian territory was gradually reduced down to what became the state of Oklahoma until oil was discovered there, and that was a loss there as well. But America expanded very rapidly and extensively. The beginning of the great immigrations from Europe, perhaps your ancestors, or maybe they came a little later. And so the beginning, it varies from one place of the country to another to the time of conquest. And so that land west of the Mississippi that was once considered a wilderness, a no man's land, now became very desirable. First, it was a trail just to get to the west coast, to get to here, by the way. The Oregon country was the first invitation to invade that. There's marvelous lands of the Willamette Valley, and the stories were there and the great opportunities out here. And shortly after that, the opportunity of the gold. And all we wanted, at least the white people of the community, was only a path through, or to go to the southwest, which was then a part of Mexico. But that era of conquest really came to be something in style following the Civil War. An amazing phenomenon, if you look back on it, we were equipped to fight one another. And the war was ended, and now America turned itself west. Land for its new immigrants. Here, perhaps, we have the finest, or that's not the term to use, expression of manifest destiny. That idea that Dee Brown says go out through that whole history, that under God or under destiny, under history itself, the European Americans were destined to rule this land. And for their own good and also for ours, these lands were to be opened up. And so the great and familiar Indian Wars are largely those that took place following the Civil War for that generation that was there. I didn't bring much in terms of books in this area, but many of you are familiar from that bestseller, Bury Heart, My Heart at Wounded Knee. Many defects, but two of the great things about it is it dramatizes that thing and says what it was like to be at the receiving end of that expansion. And he takes that period from the early 1860s and really begins essentially with Minnesota, the Minnesota Uprising during the Civil War, until 1890. And the era of conquest ends. South Dakotans have something to say about this. In South Dakota. I know that's a thing to be proud about. We always talk, Minnesota and South Dakota are almost at war these days about, which is which, and we're fighting over all sorts of things. And I think it is the case that South Dakota, or the Dakotas here, that's where the frontier ended, about 1890. And that's where the last great bloody battle between Indians and non-Indians took place, at Wounded Knee, the first Wounded Knee. But the West, had some other battles just before that. To be no more bloody encounters, and America lost interest in it. And if you go to the bookshelves, the books become fewer because the fighting of cowboys and Indians and cavalry and Indians and so forth is much more interesting than the kind of history that followed the 1880s or the 1890s. And that next era, in many ways it is still with us, we might term the era of assimilation. Indian people were now to be brought into the mainstream. The word that was put around and the churches bought into it, but it was the government policy of civilization. These people were to be made into farmers. They're to be made into Christians, not out of concern of their souls so much, but out of concern here, they would be good Americans, they would be a part of the scene. The great era of the establishment of boarding schools, of contracting with the churches who already had in place missionary endeavors and educational endeavors to bring them in. Indians were not so special in this regard because if your ancestors came over in this era at the end of the century, a strenuous effort to get those North Europeans and then the South and East Europeans into be good Americans. But the Indians are the most different of all in that respect, and they had a hard time fitting in, and many of them never did fit in. We Swedes, we gradually got in. We were slow at that, but the Indians were even slower and more stubborn than the Swedes at that point, it seems. The attempt to assimilate, and that is still a part of our rhetoric. It was assumed, and that really moves in the next sort of period that I would title the period of forgottenness. 1910 census indicated that there are only about 200,000 people identified as Indians in this country, and there'd been at least 2 million as the nation began. And the term the vanishing American was there, identified them. In the one sense, they were dying off, but the real meaning of that term, voiced by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because it was a part of their policy, that they would sort of continue to melt into the American scene, and they would not exist as a special group. Already this was happening with the Northern Europeans that were here, and we're working on the Italians at the same time, and the Indians would fit in with that. But a time when very little attention, if one looks at the literature and of the stories. Indians are off the beaten path. When reservations were formed, most reservations were in lands reserved, other larger land holdings. Sometimes they moved away from their original place, but if you know South Dakota, it's away from transportation. It is the driest land. It may be some of the most beautiful, but it is not very productive. But they were forgotten. Until some do-gooders and journalists in the 1920s, discovered that these Indians still existed, and we discovered that these people were among the poorest of the poor, with the greatest death rate for their children, with the least amount of education to prepare them for any kind of living. And a famous report came out in the late 20s called the Miriam Report that put before the country spokespersons, many of them from the churches, raised that issue. And once again, because it becomes a very periodic thing, Indians became a concern of the public. And once again, I haven't mentioned the other, it became one of the great eras of reform that began really in earnest in the 1930s. Legislation, attention by the churches and other groups concerned with Indian people. The first attempt to stem the loss of Indian land. The first attempt, nationally speaking, in an organized way to prevent or to protect freedom of religion, religious practices. But back in the 1880s, nearly all of the Indian practices that were perceived as religious, whether it was the giveaway or the sun dance or most kinds of dancing, were prohibited by regulations. Not that much concern with freedom of religion. Efforts were made to turn things around. But you know, that was in the midst of the Depression on the eve of World War II. The programs that some would say were ambitious and beautiful and constructive, sometimes ill-conceived, were really not carried out very well, and World War II occupied us. And again, that flow and ebb of our relationship with Indians following World War II, probably reaching its height in 1953. Usually when I talk to this, I put on the blackboard a list of dates, not because I love dates, but you see the flow of these things. Came another of those eras interested in termination. In fact, a resolution of both houses of Congress in 1953 said it is the purpose here of the Congress to get the government out of Indian business and as soon as possible to terminate the responsibility that the United States has for Indian people, for Indian tribes. And a series of other bits of legislation in those years, particularly in the mid-50s. Unilaterally, without consent or much consultation with Indian people, we were to do this. And many Indian tribes were terminated, and in most cases with disastrous results. Other Indian tribes were sort of threatened here and did not bode well for the future. They were not ready for it. But that period ended. And aware of the time would be, probably a number of things were a part of that change. One part, this is the beginning, again, this happened several times too, new leadership that comes out of the Indian community itself. Many of them, because out of World War II, benefits have come from that. They came in contact with other Indian people or wider contexts, and leadership came forth. Indian activism, not the first time, but again in the late 1960s and 1970s. Some date it with the beginning of the occupation of Alcatraz and a lot of events that happened in the Midwest, some of this part of the country. The Indian people felt their future would be in their own hands. And again, a responsive Congress. Congress waves back and forth. You know, they're Indians more than others are probably subject to the whims of politics. But the word, voiced probably, interestingly enough, by President Nixon. I know the Indian fellow who wrote that speech for Nixon, but Nixon sort of put his blessing upon it and is very helpful. And that has been the good word. Tribes could contract with the federal government, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and other agencies to do some of their own things. They could make their own mistakes. Over against that long history of over 100 years, somebody else was making your mistakes for you. That whole era of paternalism in which the churches themselves have shared. Has that era ended? Some people would say it is still the time. The ball is in the hands of Indian people. They're ready and willing. There are new skills there. There are new opportunities. Education is making changes in the Indian community. Too slowly, perhaps, or some economic development, I don't know. Some of my Indian friends in the past few years said that cycle, the pendulum has gone back, and we're again in an era of termination. When the federal government sort of absolves itself from its responsibility to to protect the rights of Indian peoples, to encourage and to assist them in their development. I'm not quite sure where it is, but I suspect it's one of those times of crisis in which the ball is not only be taken by Indian people themselves, but I think assistance and understanding and encouragement from people from the outside. Some of it has to affect legislation at the national level, sometimes at the state level. Sometimes it's activity that independent groups, like the churches. Gene Crawford, whom a few of you may know, is the executive for our National Indian Lutheran Board. He is a Sisseton Sioux from South Dakota. Not only because he is a Christian and a church person in this sense, but he says it is the voice of many Indian people that are concerned with the future and the well-being of Indian people, that one of the most important and trusted allies is the Christian community. Though many mistakes, their record is good and their intent is trusted in a variety of ways. Because what I've talked here is a reflection of the national level. The attitudes of people in the country affect the legislation, and federal legislation and policies affect Indian people in such a powerful way. That framework, let's begin by jumping in your questions or their concerns, where you're at, your complaints or your suggestions, but mainly to connect it with this past that we have shared. And if you make a question, I will try to hear it and repeat it so we can all hear at that point. Yes. Yeah, I'll ask some others who that. She talks about the increase of concern for the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints. That's always been there. It is a part of their theology that the Native Americans here, you know, have a special part of their calling and a special place in the economy of salvation. And they have always given special attention for work among Indian people, both human care, but also conversion on that, because they are in that special place. My friends tell me that in the West Country, in the Great Basin area, Nevada, Utah, and also into Arizona and these parts of the country, their efforts are very, very vigorous. They have active missions in many of our South Dakota reservations these days. And that is probably the top list of their missionary endeavor. My friends, for example, the Navajo Reservation, they feel that one of the greatest oppositions, they do not welcome the work of the Mormons at this point. And if you read some of the national Indian literature, like Akwesasne Notes, the National Indian Journal, which is really a superb piece, has been very critical of the tactics that the Mormons have used. Their primary method, they say, is to get children from families and to raise them and to raise the children and then to prepare these as missionaries to go back. Okay, you have no first-hand experience of that, yeah.
Yeah. Like
that was the pattern that began at the end of the 19th century and well into this century that Christians participated in at the encouragement of the federal government to send the children away to Christianize them. You put whatever meaning you want on that, to civilize them, but primarily to break the hold of the older generation so that they have a new start. I have Indian students in South Dakota that go to Brigham Young University, which is a first-rate university. If they're Indians, they get aid and assistance that's amazing. Some have loved it, said, I'll use it. Others have gone there and come back. And so I don't know, others familiar with that Mormon phenomenon? Historically, the things, there have been funds set aside partly in the Bay of Treaties that go on to higher education, and up until recently, this has not been utilized very much. Now, you know, and so Indians have had, as other students will say, a free ride. And so there's been more money available for Indian students than for others. You know, I'm an advocate of that, and the churches have put in some money on there, on that, and I think that is wise to do it. I just was with the National Indian Lutheran Board several months ago, and some of the leaders there had met with the administration, and they said it's a double thing, it's a very paradoxical thing, and they said it's typical. I make this a political comment because it is a phenomenon that they had under the Nixon administration as well. On the one hand, there are policy shifts or affirmations that said, we approve self-determination, doing yourself on your own. And they like the direction that they hear there in terms of the encouragement. At the same time, he said, when we deal with the Republican administration, they cut off all the funds. And he says, you know, we approve what you want to have, but we're not going to pay for it, or we pay less for it. And so there's an ambivalent thing, because they welcome the statement that came directly from President Reagan himself back in January of an affirmation of direction that most tribal Indian leaders would approve. But at the same time, they're concerned about the budget cuts that they feel have hurt Indian people more than most other groups, particularly in education and in human services. So it's a double-edged thing. And I would say that a general comment about the federal government, because Indian people, particularly tribal Indian peoples, are so dependent upon the federal government. Most administrations have been bad news, Republican or Democrat. They don't trust any of them. And they say, why should I vote? Because, you know, it's, you know, whichever they get. Congress sort of depends. One season they'll be helpful, one season they won't. And it's a whole wavering of Indian policy. And generally, Indian people will say that are concerned with these things, our friend in America, apart from groups like the churches, has been the federal court system, and especially the Supreme Court. Because again and again, that they have reaffirmed what they thought was just and would really help them for their future. And so if you ask most Indian people, they'll say, whatever, the Democratic or Republican, you know, bad news for them. And yes?
You hear the comment that we have really made them kind of a no people.
The comment, we made them a no people. What would you understand by that?
I guess no attitude of self-dignity and all the kinds of things that go with being a full-fledged, quote-unquote, American. Or a person living in America.
Yeah.
Is a better way to put it.
Would you agree with that? That we've made them a no people?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. And a bit of what we meant by the we on that, but the word that I haven't used thus far is the term colonialism. The pattern that we have had over against Indian people as the government and the attitude of our society is very much parallel to, you know, other nations outside of our country. And what that means is that the people who are subjects of colonialism have lost their identity. I just see this in my students, and I've seen a change on that. Students would not identify themselves as Indian, and most students with any ancestry now, not only to get the funds from the scholarships, you know, a sense of pride that is returning. And we are a people. And I think that's the single most important thing happening in the Indian community right now.
But I guess I see the white community use that.
Yeah.
As being one that is kind of like the mosquitoes in Minnesota. When the fall frost comes, the mosquitoes go away. And so, really, who is convinced of what effect, positive effect, anything will finally have? It's kind of a fatalism.
There is.
They're not carrying along with a fatalism towards it.
Yeah. You say in the part of Indian people, there's a sense of fatalism, or the rest of the community? Yeah.
Well, we came out of northern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Reservation areas there. And, there seemed to be a great deal of that. And also there, it seemed, at least our times there, the Indian community there was much less aggressive than, for instance, some of the South Dakota people or wherever.
Well, it would be that if you leave it to the Sioux or the Dakota people, they are the aggressive. Even in the Indian community, they complain about the people of Sioux, because they sort of take charge, and sometimes it's a compliment, but usually it is not. And people say, why can't we go back to the good old days when the Indians were quiet?
Well, your friend up there and lived there, and in fact represented many of them for several number of years. Basically, his attitude was that what we have today is really an unsolvable problem.
Yeah. I don't totally agree, but I can feel that. Let me just, Charlie, and then.
You need to repeat what you were saying.
Okay. He said the attitude of many, you come out of northern Wisconsin and Minnesota, that there's a sense that there's an unsolvable problem, a sense of fatalism concerning Indian relations and that. Charlie, you had your hand in.
I'd just like to make a very personal observation in terms of making Indians no persons and how I discovered my own racism over against Indians. I grew up in southeastern Washington State, about 200 miles from here, and right next to our property were three large basalt bluffs. The most inaccessible of those were called Indian graves. And in my father's generation, I think even my father participated in going up there and digging up those graves for artifacts. And that was common knowledge, and those stories were told among us. And then when we used to visit on Decoration Day or Memorial Day, my grandfather's grave in Spokane.
Personal experience, you know, that we have not, the graves of Indian people were something we could walk on and dig up, but our own graves of our own people, we held with honor. Some of you may be familiar with that famous speech by Chief Seattle that was used in worship service here earlier and will be used again, because it's been in the resource packet too, I think. That the heart of that, the beginning of that thing in negotiations for treaties for much of the land of Washington, asked the people, you know, you're taking over this land, but recognize that our people are here. You know, this land is the blood of our people and our past. Chief Seattle. Yes. Okay, let me reiterate your question again, that you know, you talk about there, you look about Indian lands are surrounded by the beautiful wheat fields, and you don't see that sort of progress there. And yeah.
In the areas where the land was really the poorest in North Dakota. And they could not raise the beautiful crops that they did in the other parts of the state. Yeah. And we, as children, even, and as our dad would drive around in these areas,
yeah.
And I wonder if that had never happened and they could have been living with the white people, if that would have worked out. What do you think? You've lived with the Indians so much.
My personal answer to that, I don't know. Number two, the overwhelming majority of Indian people I know, they, the reservations are basically a good thing because they have kept our people together, intact, and as the base upon which to build. At least that is the Indian people that are on reservations and from many parts of the country that I've seen. Historically, that is so. The Indian people are put on reservation to get them out of the past, to provide land and opportunity for progress. And they were forgotten, and they were assumed, you know, that these would sort of blend into the larger community. They didn't. You know, Indians are so stubborn on that. They didn't fit. And so I don't know if that would have been a better thing. I don't know if others feel about that, and I will share tomorrow here that the strong convictions and why that the reservations for the time being must be continued, provide lanes for Indian people to work this out for themselves. And the real enemy in that is paternalism, that you have a history of over 100 years for most Indian nations and longer for others when somebody else has been mama or papa. And if there's development, I think there will be adaptation and change. Whether we call that assimilation or not, I'm not sure.
Some of the Indians over in Tacoma and in that area are trying to form themselves into tribes. They've never been.
Yes.
And I didn't understand until just recently how important it is to be a member of a officially recognized tribe. If you're not, you're not in anything.
And Jean Crawford, who was working with is that the primary motivation for that is not for getting of federal services, because it does not guarantee that in most cases. But one of the great movements here for these smaller units, and you have many smaller Indian nations in Washington, like different South Dakota, a real desire to find their history, to find those connections, to have that sense of identity. And I personally think that this moment in history of that sense of identity that means finding your spiritual roots, which does not conflict, by the way, I think, with Christian concerns at that point, is, I think, a very healthful sign and a very hopeful sign to find themselves. Maybe I'll use this image. The melting pot, I think, for many reasons, is one of the most inappropriate images for the kind of world in which I would like to live. One of the great writers that I quote in this area, Darcy McNichol, who was a Blackfoot Indian, now dead, but also a noted author and anthropologist, said the image ought to be that of a mosaic or of a quilt. Or I like the image, and I talk in Minnesota, about the smorgasbord. I think we can all gain by the diversity and all the people that are a part of that pattern making their own contribution. We don't make it for them. You know, I hope that's not a romantic view, because there are the other issues that I want to talk about tomorrow as well, in terms of just survival, sheer physical survival, you know, of hunger and of children, of education, of the problems of alcoholism and so forth. So that has to be weighed against this problem of, I think, the wealth that we will gain from diversity. Others, yes. Yeah.
In Oklahoma, the Cherokee Nation was the only sovereign nation recognized by the United States Constitution. So it didn't do much good at that time. They had no language, no schools, no newspapers.
Let me say, you question, the 1830s and the Cherokees in particular, which was a very large nation. The Cherokees had been in large part Christianized. They'd been, quote, by white standards, civilized. They had, you know, houses. They had their free education system, most elaborate thing, and they have tremendous progress in a matter of a few years. Recognized by the federal government that that didn't mean a thing. In fact, their recognition in cases brought by missionaries in their behalf, so forth, came all the way to the Supreme Court. And Supreme Court affirmed their rights to intercede that Georgia did not have the right to take over their lands, which had gold, they thought. Not too much, but there was enough there. That's another part of the story. But that famous quote that is attributed to Andrew Jackson, Justice Marshall has made his statement, you know, let him carry it out. And Andrew Jackson had the overwhelming support of the country at that time. And so the mass movement that repeated again and again. So it said it didn't make much difference if you bought into the larger system of the country. It didn't make much difference if you were a Christian or anything else. And at least that's been a part of our past. And many of those mistakes we can't undo. I hope we just don't repeat some of them. Yeah.
Early in your opening, you talked about the early treaties and alliances, and you made a statement about that it was for they're good. And I guess what was running through my mind was from whose perspective?
Yeah, precisely. Is that many of the policy decisions of government and also treaties would be included in that, but those are negotiated, are done for the Indians' good. Exhibit A, let me just, if you know something of history. Back in the 1880s, there was passed the Allotment Act. Probably the single most devastating thing to Indian people, in particular in the loss of land, but loss of many other things as well. That was sponsored by an advocate of Indians, the Senator Dawes from Massachusetts, known as the Dawes Act. It was also supported by land interests in the West at the time, because they saw what this would be. And the impact of that Allotment Act, which was to take the reservations and to break them up into parcels of land, normally 160 acres, and adult males would receive these portions of land. And then what was left over, a surplus, it would open up here into others to come in. And there's also features in it, you know, after a period of time, Indians could lose their land, or they could protect it for a while. And the overwhelming amount of land lost was lost through that thing. But the purpose of that, from Senator Dawes, was to make them into good citizens. And to be a good citizen back in the 1880s was to be a farmer, these intentions here, and was to help the Indians to blend in, to get beyond poverty, to fit into the American system. And looking back in retrospect, it was devastating. I could cite hundreds of illustrations of well-intentioned legislations, much of it backed by Christians, that has really been harmful by most standards for Indian people. And the importance of history is to understand that if we have a part in shaping these, that we don't make some of the same mistakes that were made in the past. We have to break in a moment here.
Would you attribute that perhaps, in part at least, to the fact that the sociological thinking and structure of an Indian people as opposed to, let's say, European people was in conflict from the very beginning?
Yes, I think that's the heart of it. He said you attribute it to their way of thinking is quite different, whether it's understanding of land or understanding of other things. And neither side, if you brought it into two broad groups, really understood the other. And decisions were made, even in the best of intentions, that did not understand. And there was very little effort in the 19th century to really understand another's perspective. And I could say much more on that, and I think that is still at the heart of our problem. Thank you very much for bearing with and sharing. I hope we can have a better arrangement, but this is very helpful, what you've shared. Thank you.